supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. As WHYY broadcasts Ken Burns' new documentary, The War, we're taking an in-depth look at what this war meant to our country and to the soldiers who fought in it. Their generation has been labeled the greatest generation. They grew up during the Depression and went on to free the world from tyranny and oppression. Yet, beneath the label of greatness, we wonder, how did these men and women really experience the war? What was it like for them? What are the psychological wounds they suffered, and how did they carry them over all these decades? On today's show, we'll examine World War II vets and post-traumatic stress disorder. But first, WHYY has been recording a series of veterans in our region. Here are two vets recounting their experience in the Pacific.
All hell broke loose. We got six kamikazes coming straight in on us. There was chow lines. It was 10 after 12. There were chow lines, you know, with guys ready to go and eat. They hit our forward elevator, which was going down, and he hit it. And as it went down, the bombs exploded. And, of course, my buddy was in it, and he got a blast, and his arm was gone. And it was panicky. Now, we thought that was the end, but then we got another one. It hit us in the bridge. And he was loaded with bombs. And of course they slid out from under his wings and hit the deck. We were ready to launch an attack on Formosa. And all the planes were loaded with torpedoes, fuel, bombs. Was I afraid? I don't know. This all happened in a matter of minutes. The catastrophe after that was, I mean, it was 100 and some guys killed that quick. I mean, guys were burned like this, you know, and they tried to get me to sew bags, you know, after all this happened. And I just walked away. I couldn't do that. You know, I don't want to have that in my head.
We went from the Philippines up to Iwo Jima, and I saw them raise the flag. It's too tough. We raised the flag, or not we, they did. And they took it down and put a larger one up so that it could be seen by the troops on this 5-mile long island. And we lost over 8,000 men on Iwo Jima. That not counting the ones that were wounded.
Joining us now is Dr. Joan Cook. She's an assistant professor of psychology at Yale University and a psychologist at West Haven, Connecticut, VA. She's also published extensively in the area of the psychological impact of World War II to today's veterans. Joan, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
Our phone number, if you'd like to join the conversation, is 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. Joan, as I listened to the tape, especially the second gentleman that spoke, you could hear the emotion in his voice as though it was yesterday.
Absolutely. For many of them, time stopped so many years ago, and they've sort of suffered in silence and in isolation, and it's terrible that they have to continue to suffer alone. They shouldn't have to.
They shouldn't have to. Is there some reason they do have to or feel they have to?
That was something I really wanted to talk to you about today, Dan, because I think that the expectations they had when they came back from the war, the expectations they had for themselves and that society had for them, really told them to put it behind them. And I think we know a lot more now about trauma and PTSD from a host of other trauma populations, including Vietnam veterans and women who've been raped and sexually assaulted. And we now know that these are normal things to experience, to feel numb, to have difficulties getting the trauma memories out of your head is all normal. Well, and that there are plenty of supportive sources out there to help them work through those memories.
Well, and they come back, not just do they have the moniker of hero, the burden of hero that they have to carry, but they're also coming back in the late 40s and early 50s, mm-hmm. and, you know, getting some kind of care for your emotions meant that you were weak, period.
Absolutely. If you could let me sort of go on a tangent and provide you a little historical background of the clinical and research literatures on the topic of PTSD and World War II veterans, I think that'll help put our conversation into context.
Yeah, let me tell you where I'd like you to start,
okay.
Because the names keep changing. I mean, the mm-hmm. Civil War was Soldier's Heart, World War II was Shell Shock, and I mean, World War I was Shell Shock, and mm-hmm. now we've got Battle Fatigue. But tell us, do those name changes reflect any greater understanding of what was happening to our soldiers?
I think so. If you look at scientific publications prior to the introduction of PTSD into our official classification system, which it didn't enter until 1980, it's clear that investigators are really seeing a condition that was similar to what we now recognize as PTSD. Authors were identifying a severely disabling condition occurring after combat or captivity exposure, which involved startle reactions, sleep disturbances, dizziness, blackouts, and they used those terms that you said, shell shock, traumatic war neurosis, combat fatigue, irritable heart. But it's really, like, you get a sense of deja vu when reading these other sources. The fact that the early investigators were so insightful and that the conditions they were describing are so startlingly similar to what we see today is remarkable. Many of the investigators, though, at the time, attempted to determine the cause of the condition by inquiring about the veteran's pre-military home life.
So it's almost as though they assumed mm-hmm. that you would not have this kind of reaction to war unless you came into it with some kind of vulnerability.
Absolutely. Whether it was parental discord or broken yeah. homes or parental alcoholism, you know, we were thinking that that was the cause of these enlisted men having quote-unquote combat fatigue. And though other people were warning that fatigue shouldn't be seen entirely as resulting from pre-military family or personality instability, that was still, you know, what was widely accepted at the time. Really, war neurosis assumed that you had a personality problem. And if you think about that, given that context, why would people of that generation then keep to themselves?
Well, when I think about it, we're talking about the 40s and 50s,
mm-hmm.
and what does psychiatry and psychology mean back then but psychoanalysis and Freud, and everything goes back to mother and father.
Absolutely.
It seems to me therapists back then really wouldn't have the tools to treat trauma or even think about it.
That's right. And we know a lot more now. That is, mental health clinicians in the general community know a lot more now, and the VA mental health and physical health providers know a lot more now. We're much better able to serve the veterans coming back from these current conflicts.
That was pushed politically by Vietnam vets, wasn't it?
Absolutely. So what happened with a lot of older veterans coming back from World War II in Korea is they came back, if they dared to tell anyone about their symptoms, a mental health provider or even a family member, and I can give you examples from some of the veterans that I've worked with over the past decade, but if they even dared to tell people about their experiences, they were quickly shut down, told, you know, put it behind you, it'll go away, move on with your life, and they weren't, you know, recognized and validated in their experiences.
Tell us what happens. I wrote down a quote from the gentleman who opened the show, and he says, "Was I afraid? I don't know." So tell us what happens inside the mind, the psyche, the heart of someone exposed to that kind of trauma. Just doesn't seem to be a good enough word.
Right. So what I have been told, because I have never been to combat or been held prisoner of war, what I have been told from the men and women that I've worked with is that a range of intense emotions can occur both at the time of the event and in subsequent years. So it sounded like the one man saying, you know, "Was I afraid?" I immediately thought he was probably in shock. He was probably just so numb. And for so many of those men and women on the battlefield, at that moment, you can't experience an intense emotion like fear or anxiety, because you have to keep functioning in the role that you need to. You know, your buddies depend on you, your life depends on it. So I think one way of coping with that immediate situation is to just go numb, become on sort of like automatic pilot.
In the driven mostly by adrenaline.
I'm sure.
We're talking with Dr. Joan Cook, an assistant professor of psychology at Yale. She works at the Connecticut VA and has published and studied extensively the psychological impact of the war on World War II vets. I want to come back to mm-hmm. this issue of the psyche of someone exposed to trauma. We did a show on PTSD mm-hmm. 15 years ago, and we had a man who had PTSD, I believe, from World War II, and he had as severe a case as I've ever seen, and mm-hmm. he sat in the studio as though he was sitting in a bunker, mm-hmm. eyes darting all around, looking out windows, kind of shoulders around his ears. And he said when he got there, it was as though everything went numb inside his head and a videotape began to roll. Mm. And there was a part of his brain that was watching everything that was going on and another part that was clueless, mm. just going through the motion. And he says now that videotape rolls unbidden whenever it wants, and I'm right back there.
Isn't that so sad? So that's a key element of post-traumatic stress disorder. Would it be helpful for your audience for me to talk in more detail about the signs and symptoms of PTSD?
Sure.
Okay. So PTSD is defined the same across veterans from different eras as well as across various trauma populations. In order to meet criteria for post-traumatic stress disorder, an individual must have experienced a traumatic event that involves actual or threatened death or serious injury to self or others and include a response of intense fear, helplessness, or horror. Now, clearly, many of the experiences in the war zone meet this definition of a traumatic experience, such as duty on combat or other dangerous patrols, driving in convoys, on patrol, patrolling rivers, helicopter assaults, being under enemy fire or surrounded by the enemy, etc. And the list goes on. How many traumatic experiences that people can actually experience in combat. There's just some, you know, providing medical care in the field, witnessing or experiencing torture, atrocities, seeing mutilated bodies. The list goes on. But in order to meet criteria for PTSD, you have to experience three clusters of symptoms, and they're re-experiencing, avoidance, and hyperarousal. Re-experiencing symptoms sounds like is what you're talking about with this veteran was right. explaining to you. Having intrusive, distressing recollections. They're uninvited, unwanted memories. So you could be driving in the car or playing with your grandchildren, and all of a sudden you have this tape of World War II going on in your head. You could have recurrent, distressing nightmares or dreams. You could act or feel as if the event were reoccurring, which is very intense, you know, sights, smells, sounds, like a flashback, having psychological or physical reactions or distress when exposed to the reminders. in order to meet criteria for PTSD, you need to just have one of these re-experiencing symptoms. And as you know from talking with so many World War II veterans, you can imagine they easily meet this criteria.
I want to pick up later in the show about treatments available back then and what we're learning now about treatments. But as I listen to these symptoms and I think about vets coming out of Vietnam and Iraq and modern wars, very high incidence of substance abuse, depression, suicide, divorce, domestic violence, so on and so forth. But I wonder about the vets in World War II. It was a different era back then. So how did they cope with their symptoms?
Another great question. So when we actually look at the rates of PTSD compared between Vietnam veterans and World War II veterans, and there have been some comparisons, the Vietnam veterans score much, much higher on PTSD symptoms, on depression, on suicidal ideations, hostility, guilt, impairment at work, alcohol abuse, and things along those lines. And we're not really positive why there appears to be higher rates. It could in part be due to coping, and I could talk about that in a minute, or it could be due to the willingness of World War II veterans to talk about their symptoms. So in general, it could be that Vietnam vets may admit more to PTSD symptoms because there's fewer stigmas for that group, that Vietnam veterans may have been able to better identify psychological problems and receive treatments for such, whereas World War Two veterans may not have recognized that the nausea they felt or the clenched teeth or the difficulties relating to other people were psychological problems. They may have thought it was somatic symptoms and sought medical treatment. It could be that there was a difference at the age at the time of service, that Vietnam veterans, there's been talk that the average age was more around 19, and it was an older age for World War II veterans, and that may be a factor in their reporting or experiencing of symptoms. There's also been discussion about the differences between the wars, that for Vietnam there was no front line, they did not receive a warm reception, many of them received horrible homecomings, were called baby killers and spit on, whereas in general World War II veterans were viewed as heroes and were given parades.
So tell me in your opinion, and I've been wondering about that, what is the impact of that? The reception of the soldiers, the attitude towards the soldiers, and the fact that we lost Vietnam and we won in World War II. And I'm wondering about Iraq, which looks like it's going to have a little bit of each. You know, we are supporting our troops, but certainly doesn't look like we're going to win any war over there.
So across a large group of trauma populations, not just combat veterans and ex-prisoners of war, but a range of trauma survivors, one of the biggest predictors of who goes on to develop subsequent mental health problems is social support. That if people get support from family, friends, and society, they are much less likely to develop symptoms. And isn't that sad? Something so simple as providing validation and acknowledging their pain could help people and save people from decades of trauma-related symptoms.
That's it's sad and it's simple. Psychology 101.
Right.
We're gonna take a short break,
okay,
Joan, and when we come back, we're going to hear from Ken Rose. He's a historian that took another look at The Greatest Generation. He wrote The Myth of the Greatest Generation. We'll hear from him after our short break. We're talking about the impact of World War II on our vets, on the community, on our country, the stories that don't get talked about much because of the moniker of the Greatest Generation. My guest is Dr. Joan Cook. She's an assistant professor of psychology at Yale, and she's a psychologist at the West Haven, Connecticut VA. She's published extensively in this area. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb, and this is Voices in the Family, right here on WHYY 91 FM.
The Penn Program for Stress Management supports WHYY and features a mindfulness and intimacy program for couples. Dr. Dan Gottlieb of WHYY's Voices in the Family and Dr. Michael Boehm, director of the Penn Program for Stress Management, encourage you to experience how mindfulness can enhance intimacy, caring, and connectedness. Details at 215-615-2774 or stress.management@uphs.upenn.edu.
Are you concerned about a loved one who is using drugs or drinking too much? You may be eligible to participate in research conducted by the Treatment Research Institute. As part of the study, you'll be asked to attend up to 14 sessions with a family trainer and will be compensated for completing questionnaires on a weekly and monthly basis. For details, 877-I-WORRY-2, 877-496-7792. The Family Training Program supports WHYY.
Welcome back to Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're taking a look at World War II veterans today and how the war affected them and their families. Much of this generation's experience has been chronicled in books and movies, but there seems to be a tendency to idealize wartime America. Certainly back then. We hear of a country united in a common challenge, brave soldiers, and rock-solid marriages. Tom Brokaw coined the term the greatest generation in his best-selling book by the same title. Well, after reading The Greatest Generation, historian Ken Rose felt that the book wasn't telling the whole story. He set out to research how World War II affected our country and the soldiers who fought in it. And he told a more complex story. After 6 years of research, Rose has published The Myth of the Greatest Generation, A Social History of Americans in World War II. Our producer, Mike and Scott, spoke with Rose and asked him to describe the picture of American wartime society that emerged through his research.
Americans were not necessarily always willing to sacrifice their own personal gains for the general good. We have a robust black market operating throughout the war. We see a huge black market in meat and an even larger black market in gasoline. The government itself estimated that counterfeit gasoline ration coupons were amounting to some $1 billion a month during the war. We also see a spike in child neglect and juvenile delinquency during the war. We see high absenteeism among workers. We also see quite a bit of draft dodging during the war. Just before the war ends in Europe, the FBI announces that it has handled over 400,000 cases of draft evasion since the beginning of the war and had reclaimed enough men for 13 divisions. And in addition, let me say, we see a lot of racial tensions during the war. White workers would go on strike when black workers were promoted. There are tensions between military personnel and civilians. So it's a much more complicated picture than we've been led to believe.
What did you learn about wartime marriages?
The popular press definitely encouraged wartime romance and wartime marriage. Marrying a soldier or a sailor who was about to depart for overseas duty was praised by the culture as an act of patriotism. But it was often the case that these two people barely knew each other. And when they're reunited after the war, there are some real marital difficulties. The first full year of peace, 1946, sets the per capita divorce record in the United States. The record's going to stand until 1973 when more states have no-fault divorce laws.
And what do we know about the soldiers themselves?
Well, for one thing, fighting this war was much tougher, both in Europe and in the Pacific, than people on the home front generally knew. And the reason for this is that the government had an oppressive censorship throughout the war that protected what it called American morale. So most Americans on the home front had no idea about what the conditions of the fighting were, which were extremely tough. And wars caused an enormous amount of stress on a society, more stress than any other event. Over 400,000 servicemen killed during this war, something like 670,000 wounded. And we hadn't had casualties like this in this country since the Civil War. In addition, by July of 45, some 314,000 Army servicemen had been discharged for what they called neuropsychiatric causes. So the war takes a huge impact not only on human flesh, but also on people's mental conditions as well. I think part of the myth is that somehow American servicemen were able to return from the war and just pick up life as if nothing had happened. And that certainly isn't the case.
Despite everything that you've learned in your research, why do you think we've been holding on to the ideal version of World War II and how the country handled it for so long?
Well, I think the Second World War has had to carry a huge sort of historical burden, because the wars that Americans have participated in the 20th century and early 21st century have been uncertain of purpose and equally doubtful of outcome. But fighting World War II was never in doubt. There was no doubt that this was a war that had to be fought. And the defeat of Nazi Germany and Imperial Japan was gratifyingly clear. And for this reason, I think what actually happened in World War II has had to, as I said, carry this huge weight in American thinking.
Kenneth Rose is a professor of history at the California State University in Chico. His new book is called Myth and the Greatest Generation, A Social History of Americans in World War II. And that's what we're talking about. We're talking about the real psychological impact of World War II on our vets and on the larger culture. We're talking with Dr. Joan Cook. She's an assistant professor of psychology at Yale, and she's also a psychologist at the West Haven VA in Connecticut. Our phone number, if you want to join the conversation, is 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. Joan, Rose spoke about over 300,000 soldiers being discharged for psychiatric reasons.
Mm-hmm.
Why would someone be discharged for psychiatric reasons, and what happened to these men?
Oh, good questions. I'm not sure I exactly know. Sometimes people have asked me why I do the work that I do, and I think there, before the grace of God, go I. I have no doubt if I were in the war zone that I would come back with signs and symptoms of PTSD. So I don't want to label the problems that they had as I don't want the pendulum to swing again and talk about character weakness or pathology. People are relieved from the military for a wide range of reasons. If it's depression, or if it's combat fatigue, or if it's labeled as war neurosis, what happens to those folks? I'm afraid that, though I don't know definitively, I'm afraid that a number of them probably, again, suffered in silence, thought they were crazy. Perhaps some of them may have committed suicide. I'm just not sure, Dan.
He also mentioned that the general public didn't know much about how the war was really being fought. Do you think that just adds to the pressure to the vets to not talk about their experience?
Oh, absolutely. And you had asked me earlier, you know, what these men look like when they came home, and what did they tell us that they look like? Well, I think they responded to society's expectations to put it all behind them. They believed that emotional problems related to the war were signs of character weakness, as did the rest of society believe that. So they hid their post-war trauma conflicts. They mainly espoused the very John Wayne model, and they used a lot of avoidant and suppressive techniques. So rather than sharing their memories and feelings, which were painful and frightening, they pushed them all down inside. And unlike, not completely unlike the Vietnam veterans, but unlike the general Vietnam veteran who turned to alcohol or drugs, what I've heard a lot of the older veterans talk about is that they turned to things which were also maladaptive but looked a little bit more acceptable from society. So in order to sleep, in order to sort of function, what they would, many of them tell me they would do, is they'd overwork. So they would work two and three jobs, mainly jobs where they were quite isolated, truck driving and things where they didn't have to come in contact with a lot of other people, and they'd work themselves to the bone until they could just fall over and fall asleep. And I think many of them, you know, are now coming out new to the VA system, having suffered in silence for so long without insight, and they raised their families and they held jobs. But as the gentleman just talked about, who wrote the Myth of the Greatest Generation, many of them also had relationships dissatisfaction and adjustment problems with their families. They weren't able to be emotionally expressive or intimate, with their families and their spouses and with their children.
What formidable suffering that goes unspoken. I'm thinking about, you know, we talked about these vets coming home and being embraced by the larger culture, and I think about my personal mantra that the hunger to be known is more important than the hunger to be loved.
Mm-hmm.
So these guys came back into this country and they were loved, but they weren't understood.
No, not at all.
They were loved for the myth, for the mask that they carried, but nobody knew of their suffering. And,
no.
And these guys didn't know that they would be respected if the
people... And then I think they pushed their suffering down so far that they weren't acknowledging it to themselves either. You know, I've heard again and again from World War II and from Korean War veterans that, you know, shortly after the war, they had very negative self-disclosure experiences with health professionals and with people in their communities, which shut them down for years. I'll give you an example. Been affiliated with the VA for the past 10 years, and this is, as you said, is an area of great interest to me. And I was working in California with a group of World War II combatants and ex-prisoners of war. And one of them said shortly after he came back, someone in the community said to him, "Why did you give up? You know, why did you let them take you prisoner?" Could you imagine someone saying that? I mean, maybe they didn't mean to be so hurtful, but certainly, you know, this gentleman experienced it, and I can completely understand. You know, he said if that person had a Luger, a German gun in their face, they would have gone with the German soldiers as well. So, you know, I think they experienced some inappropriate and some unhelpful comments from society, which shut them down. And then I think there was some well-intentioned professionals who just misunderstood. So another veteran I remember telling me that when he came back from being a prisoner of war in the European theater, one of the mental health practitioners said, "Well, you're back in sunny California now. Your frozen feet won't be bothering you anymore." And to have that, you know, that's permanent nerve damage. To have that, you know, misvalidation, or to not have that pain, that physical pain, the emotional pain validated, is huge.
That's heartbreaking.
Heartbreaking
stories, and you know, war itself in our country is portrayed as black and white.
Mm-hmm.
It's good guy versus bad guy. It's good versus evil. It's our soldiers are strong, those soldiers are bad. And you know, when we look at it in those pretty simple terms, I can see where someone would say to a soldier who's supposed to be, you know, a hero in defending our freedom, you know, you should have lived up to the myth.
Mm.
You know, you disappointed me.
Mm-hmm. When truly they are amazing individuals who are human for having these signs and symptoms of distress.
Yeah, very, very human. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, I want to talk about how PTSD affects larger families. We've got several calls here from children of World War II vets who want to join our conversation. We're talking with Dr. Joan Cook, who specializes in World War II vets and their PTSD. She's an assistant professor of psychology at Yale University, and she works for the VA in West Haven, Connecticut. When we come back, we'll hear from Dr. Thomas Schaefer, who wrote Hand Me Down Hurt, How PTSD Affects People Across generations. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY 91 FM.
Arden Theater Company supports WHYY and presents Stephen Sondheim's Assassins, a musical examining the motives of celebrity-obsessed killers, through October 21st. 215-922-1122 or ardentheater.org.
The Penn Program for Stress Management supports WHYY and features a mindfulness and intimacy program for couples. Dr. Dan Gottlieb of WHYY's Voices in the Family and Dr. Michael Boehm, director of the Penn Program for Stress Management, encourage you to experience how mindfulness can enhance intimacy, caring, and connectedness. Details at 215-615-2774 or stress.management@uphs.upenn.edu.
Supporting WHYY Mainline School Night with over 500 day, evening, and Saturday courses from City Line to Paoli. Details at 610-687-0460 or online at mainlineschoolnight.org.
Welcome back to Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking about the psychological impact of the war on World War II vets. We've been talking with Joan Cook, who specializes in this. She's an assistant professor of psychiatry at Yale, and she works at the West Haven VA. But we haven't talked about much about how it affects subsequent generations. Children and grandchildren also suffer from secondary PTSD. Let's go to the phones and hear a story. We've got Carol on the line.
Hello.
Hi, Carol.
Hi, Dan. How are you?
Good.
I'm the daughter of a World War II paratrooper named Arthur Dutch Schultz, who was portrayed as a mythic hero. He was portrayed in the movie The Longest Day. He's also been written up in Stephen Ambrose's books. And the picture is incomplete. Nothing has ever been said about his trauma after the war that led to his alcoholism, eventual recovery from alcoholism on his own, and with AA 30 years later, his three marriages, and the effect on the family, the fractured family and the divorces and what happened to the children. And a friend and I created a website called Daughters of D-Day, where we've been sort of, asking for women and men to contact us about basically the untold story of World War II and the wound that the men's carried but was never acknowledged. And I'm just so happy that you're doing this program today, because it's really sort of cutting through that myth and showing the reality.
Two things, Carol. Tell me that website again.
It's www.daughtersofdday, and there's a hyphen in between dayanddaytoday.com.
Well, thank you for that. The other thing is, you talked about your dad's scars and his behaviors. What kind of scars are you carrying?
The scars that I'm carrying are probably, due to the divorce, and my younger sister died at 22 because of some poor choices that she made, like after the divorce. So I'm carrying a lot of loss scars, I think. But I didn't realize, in the beginning, I couldn't understand why my father was the way he was, or why he turned into the way he was. Although he was a loving father, then there was another side to him that was totally, like, sort of detached and out of touch. And that sort of continued up until his death through his multiple marriages. And I was just really confused. And then I started to realize about the war. I think it started after the Vietnam vets came back and PTSD became a diagnosis. And I started to put it together that this is what damaged my dad.
And what was that like for you? What impact did that insight have on you?
Well, it made me open up to him and ask him a lot more questions, and ask him to really give me a lot more background about what he really went through. Because when I saw The Longest Day when I was 13, when he was portrayed in it, it was black and white and bloodless, and he was like a lost paratrooper wandering, and that's what I thought. I thought the version of the war was that. And then when I started really questioning him in the 10 years before his death, he started really opening up to me what he went through, and it was sort of liberating, I think, for both of us.
Oh, yeah.
Because he finally got validation, And he told me that when he came back, it is pretty much what Dr. Cook is saying, that he would try to say what had happened, and nobody wanted to hear it, and they downplayed it, and so then he just shut down, and that's basically, I think, what caused his alcoholism.
Well, with your discussions, he got validation, and so did you in the
right,
process.
Right.
I've got a dear friend who has exactly the same situation. Her father was an extraordinarily difficult man to live with, and he was in World War II.
Mm-hmm.
And it was later in his life and in her life that she figured it out. He got tested by the VA, and he got diagnosed. And
right, so did my dad way later.
It was an enormous relief for both of them.
And well, then you can get closer. I mean, you get closure in terms of those painful times, you understand.
You've got a person there. Carol, thanks so much for your call. It's a great
story. Thank you, Dr.
Cobbin.
Okay, thank you.
And which brings us to Dr. Thomas Schaefer. He wrote, as I said, Hand Me Down Hurt, How PTSD Across Generations. Thomas, welcome to the show.
Oh, thanks for inviting me.
So, we know the symptoms of PTSD includes relationship difficulties and mood swings and anger. These are just some of the symptoms. Many of these vets come home from the war to young children who didn't really know them at all before they left. And now this symptomatic person that's raising them is all they know. So what impact does it have on the child's development? Is Carol's story typical?
Not 100%, thank God. But, I even personally experienced this with a father who came home from the Korean War when I was about 4 years old, and he was extremely violent for several years. And my experience is not uncommon with a lot of other people. Domestic violence part of it, the rejection and isolation, and also, sadly, a lot of times, as she pointed out, the alcohol, heavy alcohol use can go on for years and years and years.
When did you discover that your father's behavior was because of the Korean War?
It started, and it was a really interesting part of my life. I graduated University of Virginia and was interning in psychiatry there in 1979, and we got a Vietnam veteran in who had seen heavy combat, was drinking, smoking pot, his wife was divorcing him, and he was going through all this, recurrent nightmares and flashbacks of the war and rages and mood swings. And back then, we had no idea what was going on until somebody found a little obscure article talking about post-Vietnam syndrome, as they originally called it.
Hmm.
So, not only, my personal experience, but professional experience, I was, kind of there as the creation, as we just began understanding that this is one of the things that violence and sustained violence in combat does to a person.
I would imagine in many families, Tom, where there's this kind of trauma in one person, I know it's with Holocaust families, there's an unspoken rule of secrecy.
Oh, yeah.
Not to talk about what's happening with mom or dad. How does that get broken? That bond of secrecy.
It's very, very tough because one of the things, and again, this is personal experience, and I ended up working a fair amount with children of Vietnam vets because when I was with the VA for about 8.5 years, in the last several years, the VA finally started allowing the full-time doctors to have a little private practice on their own. So I saw the fathers and some of the mothers 4 days a week with my government job, and saw the wives and some of, by then, they were older teenager, young adult kids on my private practice days.
So you got to see the broader picture.
Right. And that's kind of where the Hand Me Down Hurt article and my interest came from, was seeing both sides of it. But often, with the people I saw, the code of silence was even enforced by like a fear of or a threat of violence. It's like, you know, don't push Daddy's buttons, don't set him off, because he can kill you with one finger or whatever.
And in the families I've treated, it's kind of a different kind of violence that gets threatened. You don't want to bring this stuff up because Daddy's fragile and he might break. But
right,
it's a variation on a theme. Listen, in your article, you said that it could take 3 or 4 generations to dilute the effect of trauma. How so?
I think if nothing else, even if you don't see the extreme alcohol and domestic violence type thing, with your second generation, with your children of the PTSD vet or PTSD person, you're going to see a lot of damage done, because this is a person who just, you know, can't bond very well with people, can't really, meet a good parental role. They just don't know how to handle intimacy and closeness.
And
then that's going to create a second generation kid who still has some of that.
Mm.
And so you can see, and then when you get to the third generation, they're affected some.
So you mean literally dilute.
Literally diluting. Literally, and of course, the sad thing about our culture is that I don't know that this country's ever made it 3 generations without a war.
Yeah, that is a very sad commentary. Well, I want to thank you so much for your time, and your article was fascinating, Tom. Thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, well, thank you very much for calling. I appreciate it.
Joan, you had a reaction?
I did. I'm becoming more and more optimistic. I think the Department of Defense and the Department of Veterans Affairs are doing a lot of outreach. They have a lot of fact sheets now, with wonderful websites. I can tell you about one in particular, where they're educating soldiers and family members to change their expectations. You know that the soldier is coming back. They won't be the same as before. Know that the family has changed. Everyone has changed. And they provide tips for soldiers, tips for spouses, and tips for a reunion with children. So I'm thinking, you know, some things that the soldier can do is, you know, let the child set the pace for getting to know you again. Be available to your child, both with your time and your emotions. Delay making changes in rules and routines for the first few weeks that you're back. And I'm hopeful that things will go different for this generation. I really am. I have to be.
Is there any way to prevent, not the right word, is there any way to minimize risk for PTSD in battle other than not going to war again?
I could talk a lot more about how to help ameliorate it once they come back.
All right, well, let's
get early treatment.
Let's do that, since we're running low on time. I want to hear what we've learned about treatment over the years.
Okay. I think one of the most important things that I have found in working with veterans from a range of different eras, but particularly from World War II, is very simple, basic education and normalization about trauma and its effects. I remember talking to a veteran in his 80s who had served in World War II in the Pacific Theater back when I was at the Philadelphia VA, and he had suffered for so long in silence, and a primary care nurse had recognized that he had signs and symptoms of PTSD, and she sent him to me. And all I did, Dan, was simply go through the criteria for PTSD. And he connected so many dots himself, and he cried profusely, saying, I had no idea that this was a medical condition, and that, you know, I'm not crazy. Now, most people don't have, you know, one simple assessment and acknowledgement of trauma and its effects doesn't have that, you know, overwhelming, soothing effect for most people. But I think again and again, if we can explain to people that the things that they have experienced, to have nightmares about them, to have difficulties relating to other people, to have a difficult time, you know, accessing loving feelings is normal after they've experienced what they have, can be incredible in the healing. Then I think there's a range of coping skills skills that we could teach people for how to manage their anxiety, how to better manage their anger. And these are predominantly in the cognitive behavioral area, whether it's relaxation or learning how to assertively communicate your needs rather than being aggressive, or as the earlier speaker talked about domestic violence, how to contain those difficult angry and aggressive outbursts.
But it starts off with opening them up and making them safe. I had an experience with a vet years ago with PTSD, and I asked him, we began to open these things up, and, you know, he told me stories that he had never told. And in the next session, I asked him what it was like for him to talk to me, because I wanted to talk about my experience, too. And his opening words were, "Nobody's ever been willing to smell my emotions." And I thought that was such interesting language, mm-hmm. smell. And as we explored it, the way he experienced his emotions is that they had been kept locked up inside of him for 30 years. And anything that's kept locked up in the dark begins to rot.
Absolutely.
And it felt like there was something inside rotting and stinking. And nobody's been willing to smell that.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we have to do.
Absolutely. And then I think we need to help them cope and function in the present. Though it's important for some people, and I prefer to do this kind of work individually, to go back and revisit in great detail the trauma memories and put it into perspective and learn that they are just memories. They are not occurring today. Memories in and of themselves are not traumatic. The trauma is traumatic, but so memories in and of themselves aren't traumatic. But I think we also need to help them cope with the present-day functioning. You know, what to do, what not to do. For example, alcohol may help you in the short run. It's going to get you into trouble in the
right.
long run.
And when you get more concrete, it becomes much easier. And unfortunately, we are out of time, and we're going to have to say goodbye to you. I so appreciate the work you're doing and the knowledge and wisdom you bring to this important subject matter. My guest has been Dr. Joan Cook, who's an assistant professor of psychology at Yale University. She's also with the West Haven VA. Earlier on, we heard from Tom Schaefer, who wrote Hand Me Down Hurt, PTSD Across the Generations. Keep up with this subject matter on Channel 12 with Ken Burns' documentary. Well, the engineer for today's show has been Al Bang. Shane Ewing's our intern. Christine Dempsey is our executive producer. Alisa Walters, she is our associate producer. Voices in the Family is produced by Mike and Scott. Me,